Hey everybody, this event with Scott Guild was hosted at the Bookworm here in Omaha. I was borrowing a camera and ran out of room on the disc, so there is a little bit of a pause as I hurriedly switched from the camera to my iPhone. So I do apologize for that, but I still hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the Bookworm Bookstore this afternoon as we welcome Scott Guild to Omaha and to the Bookworm as he celebrates the release of his new novel, Plastic. Debut novel, I should say.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. Erin is a plastic girl living in a plastic world. Every day she eats a breakfast of boiled chicken and conveys her articulated body to Tablet Town, where she sells other figurines, smart bodies. Wearable tech that allows full physical immersion in a virtual world. When an attack at her place of work brings Erin a too intimate experience, it also brings her Jacob, a blind figurine, whom she comforts in the aftermath and with whom she feels an almost instant connection. Scott Guild's debut novel is an achingly beautiful, disarmingly welcoming, and fabulously inventive look at the hollow core of modern American society, and a guide to how we might reanimate all its broken plastic pieces. Guild received his MFA from the New Writers Project at the University of Texas at Austin and his PhD in English down the road from the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. He served for years as an assistant director of Penn City Writers, a prison writing initiative for incarcerated students. He is currently an assistant professor at Marion University in Indianapolis, where he teaches literature and creative writing. Before his degrees, Scott was a songwriter and lead guitarist with the new wave band New Collisions, which toured with the B-52s and opened for Blondie. And his musicality does not stop there. There is also a companion album to this book that I'm sure they will talk about in the little conversation here. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Scott Guild to the Bookworm and Omaha.
How do you want to do this? Should we start out with the reading, or do you just want to dive right into the heavy discussion? How are you feeling? What do you think?
Okay, so I'm first going to say a little bit.
You're going to upset.
Just
okay.
A little bit.
Oh, go for it.
To introduce everybody to the dynamic of what is happening here, I've never done one of these conversations before.
It's going to be so good.
I appreciate the support. I saw Scott a week ago at AWP in Kansas City.
At a bar.
And I very intoxicatedly communicated how excited I was about this book project. I had seen a promotional video on Instagram with animated figures and original music that just blew my mind, and then I had read excerpts of what the book was going to be about, and I gushed. I gushed and I gushed, and Scott said, "Hey, do you want to help me introduce this book?" So I might have gushed too much, is the initial takeaway.
I was very moved, and I thought, who better, since I was returning to Nebraska,
So, the problem is I'm a very slow reader, and I've had about a week to get through the book, but I didn't get to the end yet.
Wow, okay. Yeah,
so, this will be a spoiler-free conversation, because I don't know how the book ends. So, we can start with the reading, or you could tell me, how does the book end? Well, no, I'm kidding. Don't do that. Anyway.
With a dance party.
With a dance party.
A really happy dance party.
Oh,
and
I thought so.
Everything works out for all the figurines.
That's the tone that I got.
There's pizza, and they listen to a lot of Shania Twain.
That doesn't surprise me.
It's interesting. Some of you probably know nothing about the book, so you don't even understand the extent of the joke that I'm telling right now. But yeah, no, there's no Shania Twain in the dark plastic future in which this book is set.
This is a dark, dark world. Pizza parties would be amazing. But we'll get into food later. Do you want to read an excerpt from your book?
I will read a little something. And I tried this out yesterday, and it was kind of fun, so we're going to see maybe if it'll work. Are you all up for a little crowd participation? As if this was like almost like a preschool level. When we have a how old is she now?
She's two.
2 years old. So we'll see if that works. Okay. So cute. Oh my gosh. I wish the camera could pick up the darling child. Okay. So the way my book is set up is the main character Erin is experiencing her life almost as if it's a TV show. She's sort of dissociated into, you know, experiencing her life that way. So it's written. The camera is following her, and there's this kind of television feel to the whole book. She is in love with a television show called Nuclear Family, and I always pronounce nuclear. Am I pronouncing that? I always pronounce it wrong with too much U.
No,
I go nuclear.
Right.
Nuclear. Rachel's always correcting me. Nuclear.
I think you're right.
You think I'm fine. Okay.
I think people know what you mean.
Nuclear Family is this show that she loves to watch, and there are full episodes of it in the book. So I thought I'd go ahead and read one of these episodes. It's a sitcom with a laugh track, and what we tried out yesterday in Lincoln was having the audience provide the laugh track. So when I say the audience laughs or indicate audience laughter, then you all have to laugh, and you as well also have to laugh. And perhaps you can even just lean over and laugh in my face or something. But so would we be up for that? Are we up to try? Okay, we'll see how it goes. So this is the main character of the sitcom. His name is Max, and he is, like myself, in the eighth grade, a queer adolescent, and he's in love with his best friend, O. And the twist is his friend, O, is a gigantic waffle in the sitcom. And I think, Chun, did you bring the waffle in honor of my book, or did it just sort of happen that way?
Only I know that.
Only you know. You did show up with a waffle to a waffle reading, so, you know.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
A waffle to a waffle party. So. Yeah. It was beautiful. And again, the camera can't see that there's a large waffle off screen right now, so just
to
okay.
We've got a large one.
Yeah. Well, it's a happy. I think it looks like it was large to begin with. I guess, yeah. Very good point. The best friend is a very large waffle. Okay. So, and it's written as if it's it's written. The characters are on sets. The stage legs are described. So just picture yourself going to a world of surreal sitcoms. This doesn't actually have that much to do with the main plot of my book, but I enjoy reading this part. So here we go. The episode opens on a sunny sitcom set designed to look like a quaint backyard in the suburbs. The set is simple but tasteful. A picket fence surrounds the tiny beds of fake begonias. A fake forsythia blossoms beside the bird bath. In one corner is an old stone bench, and there a plastic teen named Max sits below the set lights, a drawing pad spread open on his knees. He bends forward over the pad, his face weak with longing, sketching a sexy picture of his best friend, O. The laugh track chuckles at his drawing. O stands on the... Love it. Did you laugh?
I was helping.
You oh, so you're
more the
you're more
awesome.
The you're more the hype man than
yeah.
The hype. Okay, I see. Okay, so O stands on the steps of a heart-shaped jacuzzi. His lips curved in a sultry smile. A skimpy towel around his waist. Some maple syrup dripping from his squares. He is not a figurine, but a massive living waffle. His body a circle of toasted indents. His rubber eyes and nose each fitted into the squares of his grid. His arms two bendy shoots of rubber. Reach down to the knot of the towel, as if about to whisk it off him, revealing the region below his crispy rim. The pencil trembling in his hand, Max fails to notice when O himself strolls into the scene, appearing behind the long picket fence. The waffle, dressed in jeans and a t-shirt, ambles along on his rubber legs, his upper rim bobbing above the pickets. On the laugh trap come titters of anticipation. Hey, what you watching? O asks as he steps into the yard. Max has only an instant to slap the drawing pad shut. He crosses his legs and grips the pad over the groin of his khakis. The laugh track roars. The Eiffel Tower, he says. The Eiffel Tower at dawn. Whoa, that must be hard, O says. You've got no idea, Max mumbles to more laughter. Can I look at it, O asks? No, I mean, not yet. It still needs lots of work. You sure? I'd love to see how it's coming. Max shifts uncomfortably on the bench. Maybe tomorrow. You artists, O says, rolling his eyes in his squares. Such perfectionists. So we'll stop the scene there. But then in the next scene, Max overhears his mother on the phone and hears that she might be divorcing his father. So the sitcom episode takes a slightly darker turn. So that night, Max is in his bedroom, in the set of his bedroom, feeling very worried about that, very freaked out because he's scared that his parents might get divorced. And he is just 12 or 13 years old, having a hard time processing that. So Max lies awake that night in the set of his bedroom. The set has an aquatic theme, the wallpaper covered with penguins and bow ties, the curtains with saxophone playing jellyfish, the bedspread with dolphins leaping from a tranquil sea. A plush squid sits grinning on a shelf above his desk, its rose-colored suckers dangling off the edge. Max swings down his legs and strides across the set, stopping at a wooden cross above the bureau. He looks at the camera and begins to narrate out loud. Well, at least I'm not alone right now, whatever Mom and Dad are about to do. I can always talk to Jesus. I wonder what he'll have to say. A tiny Christ is nailed above the bureau. The Savior hangs there in his crown of thorns, no taller than a water glass. His eyes closed, a mournful mouth inside his painted beard. Max reaches out and pokes his gaunt stomach. Jesus, he calls. Jesus, wake up. I need your help. Max jabs him again, and the Christ figure stirs, his eyes snapping open. What? What is it? He says in a gruff, elderly voice, decades older than his appearance. Can't you see I'm napping? The laugh track rumbles. You're always napping, Jesus, Max replies. For the last time, stop calling me Jesus. I'm not your real Lord and Savior, okay? You're 13 now, Max. I bet you're still asking for toys from the Santa at the mall. The laugh track erupts. This is just such pleasure for me. Sorry, Morris, he says. I keep forgetting. Don't sweat it, kid. I get that your spiritual needs aren't being met elsewhere. Anyway, I'm really worried about something. Can I tell you? Morris shrugs his stretched-out shoulders, his palms straining against his nails. I'm a captive audience, he says to his biggest laugh yet. The boy explains about his parents. By the time he finishes, he is wiping tears from his eyes. I just wish I could help them, he says. They weren't always this unhappy. Morris gives him a dubious look. They weren't? Don't you remember? They'd have those weekend getaways. Dad would take Mom on dates. He'd go to a schmuggling club. Schmuggling is a sport I made up for the book where people roll around in the mud with buckets on their heads. Anyway, that's a whole other story. Max would, he'd go to a schmuggling club once a month.
It's actually the same story.
Right, I see. I see. Yeah. It's technically, it is the same story, just a more bucket-focused part of the story. So thank you for clarifying. Yeah. Yes, he'd go to a smuggling club once a month, not three times a week. That man sure loves his smuggling. Me, I can't see the appeal. Too much mud. Mom and Dad, all they need is, like, a little boost to remember they like each other. Then they'll be fine. Kid, Morris says, I'm not sure it works that way. Why not? They got married, didn't they? They liked each other then. Listen, Max. Don't you want your parents to be happy? Sure, of course, just as long as they stay together. Morris sighs. Why don't you take out my nails for a minute? I think I know how to explain this. The boy gets his pair of pliers, then prizes the nails from Morris's palms and feet. The little savior leaps down to the bureau, where he suddenly stands in a beam of spotlight, dressed in a boater hat and a seersucker suit. He reaches out a pierced hand. A glittery dance cane whizzes into his clasp. Strolling the bureau like a vaudeville stage, he sings to a maudlin piano. It's awful sad when Mom and Dad are headed for divorce. They used to kiss, but their next tryst will be in family court. And you are just a kid who can't believe a parents could pack up their bags and leave. It hurts at first, but one day you'll say, hey, there's perks for kids of well-off divorcees. The music turns jaunty on the soundtrack, the piano fast and playful, a ukulele strumming to the ragtime beat. The squid on the shelf bursts into life and bounds into the air, hooking an arm on the blade of the ceiling fan, spinning in gleeful circles. The tiny Christ tap dances with his cane as he sings the chorus. I know that you like Christmas, well, how would you like to? I know that you like presents, two birthdays just for you, two bedrooms full of toys, two bank accounts to drain, two guilty...
And this is the part where we realize that my wife's camera has an automatic shut off after so many minutes of video. Carry on.
Professional singer is much better. It's nothing like what you just heard. To clarify, you won't be listening to Plastic the album on Spotify and dealing with any of what that was.
We should be listening to Plastic, though, the album.
We should.
Because it is really good.
Thank you.
It's got a very deep Kate Bush feeling.
Oh, that's exactly, yep, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's exactly what we're going for.
So if you're a Kate Bush fan, give this a listen because it is a party.
I have vinyl singles. Vinyl. We printed vinyl.
Well, that was very nice.
Yes. I'm going to give you one for free. Others have to come.
That's nice. We'll have to get a record player.
It's also online. It's really just like a fancy poster at this point.
So before we get further into the book, I just want to first start by asking you,
yes,
as a former touring musician,
yes,
what is the difference between a book tour and a music tour?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Far less overhead. The only overhead is my own psychology, my own neurosis. Before there was a tour van filled with amps and guitars, and now there's just a 40-year-old man filled with anxiety. You know?
I should have found that funny. I feel that so deeply.
Yeah.
That was great. Sorry about that.
But I couldn't give the tour van Zoloft like I can the 40-year-old man. You know? So that also makes a very profound difference in the press. But no, and yeah, I was in the band. You were rumbling around the country, and it was you'd be loading things out. It wasn't bright during the day. It would be late at night. You know, you'd be going in. And so, you know, I love being on tour with my band, but now this is much more low key. You walk in and you're just in a sweater. You don't, you know,
yeah.
You have to look decent, but not like cool, you know.
It's me and not Blondie.
Right, exactly. Right. This is the bigger thrill, yeah, for sure. Maybe Harry's got nothing on you.
Oh, I appreciate that. That's very kind. So I read, and I think we've talked about this, but you'd been working on this book for quite a while.
Oh,
you've been carrying pieces of it
right. For
about a decade. Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you keep the writing process alive through 10 years of carrying a story like this?
That's a really great question too. And I think, yeah, it took a very long time to write the book, but there was always like a sense of like shorter term deadline. So when I was working on it for my master's, I would have a sense of like, oh my gosh, I'm taking too long to get it to my thesis advisor. And then here comes the deadline for the thesis. And then when I had it at the University of Nebraska, there were deadlines with that. And then I would get it to my agent. So I always just felt, it was like 10 years of feeling like, why don't I have enough time? Which is a ridiculous thing to say when you take 10 years. But it was always like, I was working with another, usually an individual, like my agent or an editor, feeling like, oh, I only had a few more months. This is so rushed and hurried. But then when you put all those discrete chunks of time together, yeah, it's a full decade. And
Oh my goodness.
Or 2023 was when I started doing the initial drafts. And I wrote the first draft of it in the course of like 8 weeks over the summer before I started my MFA. And I thought, wow, this book is going to be done in no time. Look at that first draft. It just flew out of me. But then the problem was the first draft was terrible. And that was that created more time.
Often that is the case.
Yeah, especially when you're writing it that fast and, you know,
Yeah.
You don't know what you're doing.
Because
you've been in a rock band for the last 7 years, and you think, I can be a novelist. I'm sure there's nothing to it. Yeah, of course. Just as long as there's enough pages, there'll be a novel.
How do you feel about the coincidence of Plastic coming out the same year as Barbie?
That was really a remarkable thing, because the book hadn't been about plastic figurines from the start, but it had been since about 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And that had been the big thing, where it's like, oh, now it's... It had just been this sort of dark speculative novel before that, but it was really exciting to be like, oh, if I take this dark speculative novel and put in plastic figurines, it becomes zany and upsetting in a more kind of, you know, odd way. It just felt like its own thing rather than like a generic sci-fi novel at that point. But I did have this worry, it's like, is anyone going to be able to understand what I'm going for with the plastic figurines? This is so like kind of out there. People would be like, plastic figurines, I don't want anything to do with this. And then literally, I think I turned in the final drafts to my editor in like mid-July last year, like right at the Barbenheimer moment, when it's like, we as a culture want plastic figurines and apocalypse, which are like the two things that are going on in
your book.
Right, it's like plastic figurines dealing with apocalyptic vibes. And it's like, I guess this was mainstream all along. I guess, you know. And that's why I'm a millionaire now. I've been selling thousands, you know, as you can see, you know, everyone, everything is, Greta Gerwig is waiting outside to film it. But it was a wonderful, it was a really exciting moment of feeling like this is going to be accessible to people rather than just like alienating to people, because we're all used to figurine narrative now, we're into that. Even though in Barbie they aren't, they're like sort of like inflected plastic a little bit, but my characters move real stiff. You know, maybe that accounts for the sales difference between my book and the Barbie movie, is they're actually like, you hear about the hinges and so forth.
Yeah. I think that was one of the things that I really liked about the first two-thirds of the book that I've read so far.
Right.
Is...
Yeah, no, the last third is awful. I'm so glad you... Yeah, I thought you would have even come.
Just didn't know how to close it. No.
It's a great ending.
It is a great. I could already tell.
How can you don't actually...
Because I'm also a fiction writer.
So you're inventing a fiction about the fiction.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
I know. I
thought you were saying you were inventing a story about the end of the book to say...
Pretty much.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I love, though, is I think the use of the figurines, the use of the dolls, gives it a very strong feeling of the uncanny throughout, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's... The things they're experiencing are traumas not far from our own world. You deal with like mass violence, you deal with like ecological threat. There's a bunch of things on people's mind, and also their means of coping with those threats to their existence. But they're all figurines.
Right.
So there's this sense of slight distance and slight safeness where I think it actually enables you to see the reflection a little closer, right, to our world from this post-apocalyptic thing, which I found fascinating. I'm questioning I actually tried, I've been working on this question all week because...
You're a wonderful person. You care. That's so nice.
Yeah, so...
People do roll into these moderate things like, so, plastic figurines, huh? What was that? Why was that?
Well, okay, so here's what I wrote. But, as the book goes on, it seems that you were wrestling with ideas of perception, grief, and coping with the insurmountable. I won't ask you, what is reality? But I am curious how you think about your use of the uncanny in the book, or that nearness, closeness, but at a distance. How do you approach that idea now?
I think, you know, what you're talking about makes me think a lot about the experience of the book, and before the uncanny was mixed in there, I felt at a distance from the material, because I felt like I was dealing with more kind of just like sci-fi tropes, like here are these people in this dark future with the eco-terrorism and ecological threats and the virtual reality that's alienating them from real relationship, all stuff that I'd kind of seen before. And then when the figurines came in and it got a bit uncanny, I felt much more intimate with it. And I think it has something to do with the way particularity works in fiction, that like once something gets more specific, you can feel more intimate with it as a writer or something like that. But I know at the reading level, it must be, yeah, you could have a, oh, hi, I love that this is being filmed and there's just all this gesturing off camera. It's like, there's a child, earlier there was a waffle, I got all excited. Someone actually showed up with a waffle, can you believe it? Anyway, whatever. Right. Yeah, so a man just ducked out from behind the cart and then went back. It's all happening around me. Okay. So I have to stay unfocused, though, because again, all of this is off camera. So yeah, I feel like, and I'm interested to actually hear from you, when you started reading the book and you started entering into the world that was plastic and was a bit distancing, did you feel like, oh, this is a metaphor for our own world and the echoes of our own world are bringing me closer to this? Or didn't you feel like, this is like a barrier that's been set up that once I get familiarized with it, I will myself have been weirded.
And this is the part where we realize she accidentally gave me the 8 gigabyte SD card and not the 32 iPhone to the rescue.
The UNL program, that was my submission. I don't know what it was about sending this vicious terrorist attack sequence that got me into a PhD program. They thought it was cool. Or not cool, but you know.
That says more about them.
It may perhaps it does. Yeah. Let's not look too deeply into that. But then, yeah, when I went back and rewrote it so that instead of that, the limbs are snapping off, or you see, like, someone gets shot in the head and, like, the top of the head, like, whizzes off, and you see the hollow basin without any brains inside or anything like that. Somehow that I could feel in my gut the sort of horror of that in a way that I wasn't desensitized to. So that freshness or something. And then I feel like it just, you know, it would be so wonderful if I'd had some fancy theoretical idea behind it and I could explain, well, I was trying to do this and this and this and these were the themes. But really it's just a product of writing, working on scenes for years and always feeling stuck with them and finally feeling like, oh, something, you changed one little thing and all of a sudden you can see it and you can feel it and then you have to follow that and then later on you can pretend that you had really brainy ideas around it and, you know, create theories of why it works or something. Yeah.
I mean, that's so cool because we often... Like, lots of us here are English teachers.
Right.
And we've talked
to
our students about writing is a recursive process. This is a thing that we go back to. And,
and
every single time you should be discovering things about your text. And it's interesting to hear about it on such a scale, on a massive level, for your book. That's really fantastic. I can't praise this book enough. It really is a fantastic read that I am very much enjoying.
Buy it. Buy.
So, we've already talked a bit about...
That was supposed to be at a frequency too low for people to be aware that they were hearing it, just kind of like a subliminal, you know. We can continue.
It's all right. It's your show, man. I'm just support. So, in the book, the characters, Jacob, Aaron, everybody else, they use a modern slang, which is basically the most cut out vocabulary possible, like the most sparse. So I got to thinking, when I was thinking about this interview, how would those characters describe your book?
Like much wow make cheaper or something like that.
Yeah.
For those of you who aren't familiar, let me just read you.
Oh yeah, this is a good time. Segue. I meant to do that.
No, that's fine.
That's
so we're not going to read much, but you know, like Aaron invites a guy over for dinner, right? And he's sitting at the table. Glad food, he says. Okay, if start. Death, Aaron says. Enjoy. Forget eat lunch, he adds. Big hungry. Hope chicken good, she says. Just throw on after work. Really? It look wow wow. He scrapes the meat to his plate with a wet slab. And then, you know, Aaron serves herself and she crosses herself to bless her food. You religious, he asks? She shrugs. Kinda. Cool. You go church? Yeah. Now then, where go? So it's like that. Like, at this moment in 2080, 2090, the characters are all talking in this stripped down kind of text speak. But then when Aaron has her inner monologue, or sing songs, she's speaking in like a full English. Anyway,
and also, as the earlier reading demonstrated, the show also uses the
full, yeah,
full sentence.
And it's almost like because she's obsessed with that show, she can access that kind of language inside herself, though she talks in the modern day, whatever vernacular.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
So, again, how would it be described? Shiny or major blummo?
I think the characters are feeling blummo, but. Yeah. Hopefully you're finding it shiny.
It is very shiny.
Shiny. And when something's cool in the book, they call it clunky, which was a word I made up.
Yeah.
Blummo and clunky were my happiest.
Yeah.
And someone tried to take Blummo out once from the book, and my agent wrote this email. Not angry. He wasn't angry, but he was like, Blummo will not be leaving. He came in and weighed in.
Blummo is the best word. I think we've all felt Blummo at some point in our life.
It means kind of like bummed out.
Like bummed out and like pessimistic and like just a very negative outlook on everything. I'm feeling major blummo.
You get a tattoo.
I'm probably going to. Yeah. I have several tattoos scheduled.
Really? Tell us about one quickly.
Al and I have been talking since we first met about getting matching tattoos.
Oh, that's cool.
Like on the first day we met, we talked about getting matching tattoos from Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Oh, that's awesome.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, so, surprise. okay. Yes, I like the description, Mike. You've already mentioned this. You're vegan, right?
I am a vegan, yes. I am.
What is the deal with boiled chicken in this world?
In the world, the characters only eat boiled chicken.
Only. It's it.
Throughout the book. Whenever people are eating, it is some version of boiled chicken. Boiled, there's no, the word cooking isn't used, just boiling. Yeah, I mean, I guess I didn't think about it too deeply. This is one thing I would recommend. If you're ever writing a weird experimental novel, surround yourself with intelligent professionals, because you can then just bring them the ideas. So the boiled chicken got through, they said, oh, we love this. And so I didn't think about it too. I said, I love it too. They're just eating. And I, you know, it was one of those things. It has to have something to do with my horror of meat though, right?
Yeah.
How could it not? And because in the descriptions of the gleaming boiled chicken and the dripping
and the slurping.
There are some people in the crowd who have already bought the book who are thinking, what have I done? With the boiled chicken and the blummo and the...
As an omnivore, it really often made me question my choices.
Yeah, it's sort of the subliminal meat horror in there, sure. But I think, you know, also these are plastic figurine characters too, so I think maybe I'm just like horrified by the whole natural world and the body and, you know, there's this... Or I have a feeling that we're all so alienated that that's something being communicated or, yeah... Your idea, what do you think the boiled chicken means? I mean, honestly,
it's not fair because I know you. And I remember having a conversation about vegan hot dogs.
Right.
And your obsession with vegan hot dogs, which sounds horrific to me. And the whole time,
The vegan hot dog?
Yes.
It was horrifying. It's just lovely synthetic meat substitutes.
And I'm like, what is your deal with chicken?
By serious men. Like,
I don't feel like you have right to judge chicken on the basis of your vegan hot dogs.
I'm not putting down chicken qua chicken. It's just, you know, the gleaming and the glistening. But, you know, I honestly, most of the food I eat is designed to look like meat because I grew up in the suburbs eating, loving just the endless consumption of meat. And then I stopped. I became a vegan for various reasons. But then, yeah, the vegan hot dogs, the vegan hamburgers. I love vegan chicken nuggets, vegan pizza with vegan sausage on it. So there's parts of me that's clearly pining for a meatier past.
In some sort of...
Just regretting the words as they leave my mouth. Yeah. They're already out. I didn't know this would be filmed. I would have taken...
Forever. Yeah.
Yeah, forever, immortalized.
Oh, boy.
Right?
Yeah.
I'll have to try to get the entirety of YouTube taken down or something.
Do you want to read anything else from your book or anything else?
No, I don't think I have that. I didn't have another reading planned for the book.
Okay, cool. Yeah. We don't have to do that. It's very much worth reading, though. So please, yeah. Does anybody in the audience have any questions based off of the scattershot conversation that we've had?
It was a wonderful conversation.
Oh, thank you.
Wonderful job.
I'm so fascinated by this process of making up language and discourse and like also sports and like this whole world with all its idiosyncrasies. And I'm sitting here as not a fiction writer, so I wonder if you might tell a little bit about like what the construction process of that is like, or like do you have to, how do you keep it all in your head when you make up these rules and these discourse, like
right,
what does that
right.
look like?
I will say when you invent a, like a sport like Schmuglin, and then you send it to like a professional editor in New York, they do respond to you, we don't need like 3 pages of rules that you give in the text of the novel. The level of interest for the general reader is not going to be there. So it goes down to a few evocative passages of people like crawling around with a bucket on their head, and they're comfortable with the reader making up their own kind of. But I mean, I could, you know, if anyone ever wanted to play Schmuglin, we could do it with great specificity, you know. Schmuglin is I think it might like hurt our knee. We would need the proper padding.
Well, I'm not playing.
We're gonna just run out to the field.
I've read the book.
You read the book.
Most of the book.
Yeah.
So
it didn't appeal to you. Really, the only one on the hands and knees is the Schmuggler. The Schmuggler has it worse.
Yes.
Max's father is, you know, you have to almost, it's almost like a little bit of like a sadism to be the Schmuggler.
Yeah. You're asking for punishment.
You are, because you just have to, the ball has to land in the bucket on your head and you have to be on all fours at all times. And it's, so that's a great question. How does one come up with something so brilliant as this? From whence comes the Schmuggler?
Yeah.
I love that question. I love this whole conversation because it's, I guess so much of the book coming together was very process-based, where it's like, it always felt like kind of a dream to me, the working on a novel. Mm-hmm. And for many years, the book was like a dream that was resisting me and I couldn't get inside. And I knew there was like a book there, and then suddenly, something happened. Maybe it was like 2 years after dropping one. Maybe the world got dark enough or something that some sort of like thing went off in my head where I was like, screw it, like smuggle it, you know, let's go. You know,
And President Waughlin.
President Waughlin is kind of a Trumpy.
He's a very Trumpy.
As Trumpy as a waffle. The waffles are very conservative in the world, and O is, you know, alienated from his family. Anyway, so. It's
a whole thing,
yeah, for sure. But yeah, I think the process of like feeling like you get into the dream of the novel and then there's like, oh, they're going to play a sport in the novel. Oh, okay, they're playing soccer. And you're like, like everything else sort of surrounding it is so zany. So then you're always like, okay, let's invent one more thing. And then you look up and indeed 10 years have passed, but you're kind of... But I mean, that's the joy and the fun is like you get so lost inside of it and it all feels so real that you kind of like, you're always writing about plastic figurines, but you forget to yourself that there's anything odd about that either. Or like one of the main things in the book is people get this thing called Brad Pitt disease where like their skin turns to ash. They're like, you can laugh. I mean, it's not like a serious, real. Actually, my aunt wrote to me, she's like, I looked up and I guess Brad Pitt actually does have some sort of like serious disease. So I had not known.
Oh man.
It's in connection. But so that I felt
he's,
bad.
He's going to come for you.
Yeah, he could probably successfully sue me, let's be honest. With his amount of money, he could sue me in any way he wants.
So please buy the book quickly.
Please buy the book to fund my Brad
legal fees.
My Brad Pitt legal fees. So yeah, so they have this disease. I forget where I was going with that.
Invented things.
Oh yeah, so you come up with that because just giving a figurine like cancer, which was the initial version of it, didn't have the same kind of like impact to it. So.
But again, I think those inventions also help with maintaining that level of difference, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like when you encounter the description of Brad Pitt disease, it's brutal enough, it's slow enough, and sad enough that you read. It's like, oh, well, that would be cancer in our world. That,
right.
You know, even though the description's very different. And again, it's that sort of uncanny level where you get sort of, ha-ha, Brad Pitt disease, that's funny. And then you keep thinking about it, and you're like, wow, this is really sad. This is really heavy.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Oh, yeah, please.
So this book seems very creative, which makes me really excited.
Oh, thank you.
But
also curious, you said you've been working on it for a long time. When you first started writing bits for it, what was different? And like, you kind of touched on it, but how did this all start back 10 years ago? What was it like in comparison to now?
Yeah, it was plastic people, and you know, I think honestly one of the big differences was it wasn't about two characters falling in love and trying to start a relationship in a world that was chaotic around them. It was about someone who was so alienated that she couldn't really reach out for a relationship, so she created like a virtual reality, like avatar, and started a relationship with someone like that she knew but couldn't approach in person. So it was almost like a story about like someone being catfished a little bit, I guess, in a way, like a gentle form of figurine catfishing. And I mean, that was the version of the book for a very, very long time. And I think that was also one of the things that was holding the book back a little bit, because the main character never could have a full emotional vulnerability to the situation. And there wasn't the possibility that her life was going to turn out a whole lot better because of the relationship, because it was all based in lies and things like that. So it was actually after the book sold and I started working with this editor who touched on that point that I said, ah, gosh, what if this was like actually just like a real like love story? And so I took out a lot of that tricking and stuff like that, and the book shifted a lot. So there was a sort of big like emotional shift, I guess, in the book. But I mean, over 10 years, the other answer to your question is like just about everything changed, you know, like really just about everything.
Yeah. Like what sparked, I guess, what was the original spark of idea that even started the novel, like the first thing?
Yeah.
Did you touch on that? I missed it. I'm sorry.
No, I didn't. I was living in Boston at the time, and it was actually right around the time of the Boston Marathon bombings. And so I was living there. And this was right around, that happened, and the people who had committed the bombing lived like maybe two or three blocks from where I was. And so the whole city kind of shut down. I don't know if anyone remembers what this is. Yeah, the whole city kind of shut down for a few days. You weren't even really allowed to like leave your house, or you weren't supposed to. And camera crews were everywhere, and tanks were rumbling through the streets. And it was like, I can remember there being this moment of feeling like, I had known there was this like darkness and chaos in the world around me, and obviously I'd been like a freshman in college for like 9/11 and so forth, but it was so intimately close that something about that, I think, brought the desire to write about like a darker speculative world where some of these things were a little further along. But I mean, anyone, like the people in my master's program that I brought that version to, and it wasn't called plastic back then, it was called Dead Limbs, so you can imagine how different that must have been. They're all amazed to hear that it's like a comedy now, because it would be like, okay, let's workshop Scott's book. It's like lovely sentences, like a little sad though, don't you think? You know? And I would always be like kind of like joking, be like, like, yeah, your book is not. There's like, it's like you have this feeling with writers sometimes, right, where you meet them and it feels like major portions of their personality are missing from their writing. And you're like, I wish that I could find. So anyway, yeah, so I did feel like over the years something missing came in that way too, humor.
See, where I go the other way and I meet writers and then I read their fiction, I'm like, oh, this is what you're like.
Oh, interesting. Or you're like, I wish it had less of you. There's too much of you.
There's a lot of apocalypse happening.
I need you to calm down. No, but that is interesting too, when you meet someone, a writer, and they seem like very happy and like everything, and then you read their work and it's like all, you know, torturing raccoons
or
something.
Fiction.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's most of what you read in graduate programs, raccoon torture, things like that.
Any other questions? Or?
Yeah.
Before we move on to book two, Schmuggling Rules and Regulations.
Sorry.
So, no, that's fine. Two questions, one semi-serious, one just for fun.
Oh,
and see. You can answer them in any order you want.
Okay.
One, what is a day in the life of Scott Gild?
Mm.
And two, to appeal to the male demographic, do they have Kung Fu Grip?
Wait. Does who have Kung Fu? Do I have Kung
the
Fu?
The plastic...
The figurines.
The figurines.
Oh, I'm not even familiar with what is Kung Fu Grip?
It's a G.I. Joe
thing. Oh, it's a G.I. Joe thing.
They could, like, grip swords and
I need
stuff.
To call my editor and get a new version going. This is terrible. No, I didn't give them settings.
But they have articulated figures,
so
I'm sure they could grip somebody.
This is why I shouldn't talk about the book with anyone, because I'm going to want to go back in now. If they had little settings,
late.
You don't like... there's nothing I can do about this. It's over.
You can just write another book.
Yeah.
I can't write another plastic figurine book. They'd kill me. I showed up.
Even more
they wouldn't kill me, they would just not publish it. My agent might be like, oh boy. One more time. But okay. Kung Fu Grip, no, I'm afraid not, and I'm so sorry, and I'm sorry in a more global way as well for myself and for the readership. But, so the years working on this book were very much, like, you wake, like, six, try to, like, 5-6 days a week, wake up in the morning, have coffee, like, be, like, decent to my significant other. My wife is the brilliant author, Rachel Cochran, who wrote a book called The Gulf over the summer that came out from HarperCollins. It's wonderful. Everyone should check that out. It probably is even here, I would imagine. It was at Fancy and Finch yesterday. Anyway, and then, yeah, I would try to work about 5:30 every day. So Rachel is someone who can wake up at, like, 6:30, 7 a.m., and in 90 minutes do what it takes me about 7.5 hours to do. So I would sit there, rewriting sentences, coming up with the rules for smuggling. Somewhere in there I would need a nap, a large chunk of vegan meat substitute at a key moment, maybe a little additional caffeine. But yeah, a lot of long work. One of the nice things about meeting Rachel was I got a little less isolated than I had been during my master's. At that point, I would clock in and out when I worked, and I would keep track of my hours. And if I reached certain time thresholds, I would give myself a star. And then at the end of the week, I'd count up my stars. And I'd have my weekly stars, and then if I reached monthly goals with the stars, there would be star multipliers. So I was close to institutionalized. And but when I met Rachel, I said, maybe I can just work 6 to 7 hours every day, and I don't need the star system to undergird this labor. So,
do you miss the star system?
Oh, every day. Yeah, I do. No, the star system at the time was exciting and a thrilling thing, obviously.
But ultimately
did seem like a strong symptom of depression, in the bigger scheme of things. But I think, yeah, the book was written with a lot of like daily kind of intensive work. And then one of the things that's really helpful that my thesis advisor told me about is you reread at night what you worked on during the day, like right before you go to sleep. So like your kind of dream life takes it on, so yeah. So there would be that sense of like wanting to dream about it too. And like, yeah, it's been strange. So when I finished the book, I think that was one of the reasons I made the album was like, I was like, the book is done. What am I gonna do, start a new book? No, I'll make a complete album about these characters telling the story of the book again. So I'm a little bit
did that happen
frazzled
during
now
the,
without Aaron.
Did that happen during the editing process, the album creation?
Or? Yeah, it was about a year ago, so the book was wrapping up a little bit, and I'd had the idea earlier to put songs in the book, and my editor had been okay with that, and then I said, what if there were actual songs? And yeah, the publisher really, really loved the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, they got on board with it.
I actually managed to get most of the way through the book, thank goodness, because there's also an amazing audiobook.
Yes.
And the voices that are, plural voices, that's rare in an audiobook.
Yeah, they were very, and the songs, a lot of the songs from the album are in the book too.
Yeah, it's really good.
Have you heard the audiobook?
I that's where I'm.
Oh, wow, that's great. I haven't heard it because it's only been out like less than a week, so I haven't heard the audiobook yet. The audiobook was directed by my second cousin, Lisa Watstein, and I had not known this. So the producer said, oh, you might know the director. It's Lisa Watson. I've known her my entire life since I was like a little boy. So we got to work really closely on the audiobook, and that's rare too. So she was just a very good audiobook director.
Yeah.
Total surprise.
It's an amazing audiobook.
Oh, that's great.
I'm really enjoying it. So cool. Unless there are any other questions, we will cap with the classic. What's next?
Oh. Yeah, I have to somehow, you know, it's been a long time in the plastic world, and I have to find another weird world to go to, you know? And there's a couple possibilities, and I just hope they let me in, you know? That's a feeling of, like, I don't function too well unless I'm inside of some sort of very complete, odd, imaginative terrain. So I don't know. I got to get in there. Everyone pray for me. Let's hope it works out.
That sounds great. Well,
yeah. Well, does it? Well, it hopefully it will be great, yeah.
I mean, looking for new worlds is sort of all entire Star Trek thing. It's wonderful.
Oh, okay,
so, yeah. Let's just go with that.
If I don't can't write something, I'll just watch a lot of Star Trek.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks everybody for this. Thanks to Scott.
Thank you.
And that's all I got.
Delightful.
I got it.
You guys can. all right, well, thank you so much for coming, and again, supporting our event with Scott Gill. We do have books available for sale. They are behind the counter, so if you're interested in a copy, you can get it there and then bring it back to be signed. And we'll just have a line kind of snake down this wall. And then Scott also mentioned that he does have the 7-inch singles with him. The sales of that, he's handling, so they don't know about that at the counter, so don't confuse them. But yeah, thanks so much for being here. Let's thanks Jason and Scott one more time.
Beautiful.